plays that I'm proudest of are related to technology. Actually, three of them. One of them is the one that recently had a stage reading through Playground, Seven Secrets of Teaching Online, which is about March 2020 through September 2020, and these college teachers trying to figure out how to use technology to connect with students, and in the process, having all kinds of personal connections evolve. And then the other one is FIRST, which is the story of Bill Gates at 19, fighting with the ham operators and, hobbyists who wanted to share his software and felt that they had a, you know, the idea that you couldn't share software was just not something that someone who hacked around with hardware to do cool things would ever dream could be true.
Playwright Evie Pyne is our guest this time on the Plutopia podcast. We explore her involvement in online communities, education, her acclaimed series of plays, and one-woman shows.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network's podcast. Our guest today is Evie Pyne. Evie's plays wrestle with moments when life feels so new your hair is electric. I got that phrase from your input there, Evie, and that sounds great. My hair is definitely electric, especially today.
But it looks great.
She also teaches performance studies at San Francisco State University, and she managed Computer Programmers for Social Responsibility and directed the second iteration of the Community Memory Project. She developed the Working Families Online Roundtables for HandsNet and launched the first online community for California Community Clinics. And she's a proud member owner of the world's greatest online community, The Well.
Yeah.
Where we both hang out, by the way.
Absolutely. We're
so
better.
Fantastic. Fantastic to have you here with us, Evie.
I'm thrilled to be here. It's really exciting. I was so thrilled that you just interviewed John Coate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Talk about a guy who should have a MacArthur Genius Award, man. He's like, people forget, he's the guy who, in a way, anybody who's doing online moderation or building online communities, they owe it all to him. And we see in communities where his kind of vision is followed, there's a powerful connection. It's really quite remarkable. He's just one of the most important people in the computer business who doesn't get sung about enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, and he got in on the ground floor with The Well, but also you were kind of on the ground floor too, your involvement with Community Memory. As far as I know, that wasn't that the very first bulletin board system, BBS?
I don't think it was the first bulletin board system. Maybe I was in on it when it was very much a local online community where they were really trying to prove that bulletin boards, the internet would be of interest to tow truck drivers, to night nurses, to people who were not at all involved in tech, but who wanted to connect. And part of why, you know, I have a lot of pride of being part of that is we find that basically Community Memory proved that that was possible.
And was Community Memory, was it a foundation for The Well? Did The Well sort of spin off from that?
No, they were sort of parallel paths. Community Memory was really this idea of putting computer terminals that were linked by modems in public places. And The Well was very much people at home, or let's face it, at work, who had computers themselves, a place for them to connect, particularly initially freelance writers, and then of course deadheads. So they were different, but they were sort of showing the same thing, that you didn't have to be a nerd to leap in and find connection find value.
The smart thing about the well was that just by who they targeted to be initial members, they got people who were really articulate and creative and, you know, garrulous, you know, people who would talk.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember Stuart Brand saying, which is absolutely true, remains true to this day, is that in terms of in text-based services, great writers lift all boats. You get a couple of people who write well, and then other people want to live up to that. And so the well was brilliant in saying there are all these, you know, freelance writers sitting at home trying to figure out what their next sentence is and, you know, where would they like to go? Well, they could come on the well. And then that made the rest of us write and respond better, you know, and talk more. I mean, I still see that when I teach in like online discussions. If I can get a couple of the really great writers in a class to, you know, pop up first, the discussion is just more in depth. The language is more evocative. The whole dance of that communication is transformed.
Yeah, and our experience has always been that there are people who are more garrulous, who will speak more, and they tend to be, it's almost like they're on a stage and other people are sort of watching them. You know, that's kind of the way I've thought about online community, you know, the idea that we have lurkers, but I think of them as just like the audience for the conversation that's going on.
And yet I think the irony is in the best communities, there aren't that many lurkers. Because they, and the well is one of them. I mean,
sooner or later they speak up.
Yeah, people speak up because that looks fun, right? The other people are demonstrating, wow, it's a blast to share your opinion. So, yeah, it's very cool.
And when we, go ahead.
Oh, and at Community Memory, our challenge was we weren't targeting who are the, you know, who are the most articulate, the best writers to get on board. We were targeting when I came on board, we had a grant to get seniors on board, to get disadvantaged families, and one other group I can't even remember. But, you know, so those were people who came on board really thinking, oh, I've got something I want to share and I want to talk with the other experts and interesting people about. At the same time, one of the funniest experiences I had at Community Memory was I was trying to get people who were seniors. They were probably my age, maybe a little older. And of course, Community Memory, it was right when I was there, it was right when ATMs were starting to show up. And they were kind of these miracle things where that you could go and get, put a card in and get money out. No one had, it was wild. And there was this one woman at the senior center who just didn't want to look at Community Memory. She didn't want to look. And one of the things she said to me is, I'll never use an ATM. You know, why are they getting rid of bank tellers? I mean, we all know the rap that she gave. She was in Berkeley, right? And the thing that was so funny, so finally I convinced her to log in. So she puts in a username, and then we wait. And we wait like 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. She turns to me. She's never been on a computer before. She's never used an ATM machine. She turns to me with her hands folded across her chest and says, this thing is so slow. It's like, huh? Like, what do you mean, lady? You know, like, what's your idea of speed? She'd never. So it's interesting, not being a developer, not being a computer human interaction person. I think it's fascinating how our expectations get set, even in situations like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, how well did it work? I mean, what level of adoption did you have at Community Memory? Was there a huge number of people or?
There wasn't a huge number of people. I think that what was most interesting to me was seeing people connect with people who they wouldn't have connected with before. You know, a college professor who links up to play a game of chess with someone and then discovers that person, when they meet up, doesn't have a home. Right. Or someone at the senior center who's read, who's nuts about a certain novelist and is talking to a, you know, a high school student who's nuts about the same novelist. And in community memory, you could be anonymous, unlike the well, which is just the opposite. You have to be who you are on the well. And it's interesting, the pros and cons of both those approaches. One of the things that was used for a lot was by high school students organizing parties. Like, I'd read these messages that I could barely understand, and I'd realize that what they really meant was, my parents, you know, are going to be at church late on such and such a night. So anybody who can read this message, come on over, you know, until midnight, then you got to get out of here. So, yeah.
You know, the thing that really drew me into the online world was the ability to communicate with people elsewhere, different parts of the country, different parts of the world. But I eventually was attracted by the fact that I could meet people locally that I didn't know exist, that had the same interests as me. And that was a real value that I immediately started proselytizing to other people. Said, you need to get on this stuff. It's worthwhile. And a lot of people go, I don't want to get a damn computer. That didn't last long, because once people experienced it, it definitely drew them right in.
Yeah, it is so interesting that people forget that there was a point where there wasn't this, and then there was. And I agree with you. I think that that idea, both of those things are very compelling to me. The idea of, I meet people locally who I wouldn't connect with otherwise, but also, I mean, you know, the well, that I've met people from farther away who I would never meet, one of whom, may he rest in peace, is Austin's own Ed Ward. And just what a pleasure to know that guy, who there's no other way I can imagine I would have ever connected with him, you know, except seeing him as an author that I adored. And then suddenly, through the well, it's like we're treating each other like equals, even though I'm sort of like, it's Ed Ward, right? So, I mean, there's a marvelous capacity for that also online.
Yeah, I was lucky to meet Ed face-to-face in the music business, because I was a music journalist in San Francisco, and of course he was kind of the king of the music journalists in our area. And I didn't really meet with him online until he moved to Berlin. And, because before that, you know, it was basically face-to-face. But yeah, he was indeed a treasure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was a great thing for somebody like Ed, who kind of moved around a lot and spent a lot of time in recent years. Before he moved back to Austin, he had lived for quite a while in Berlin and then in France. I guess he was in Montpellier in France. And he was able to sustain all of his connections with people stateside through the internet, and I think that was extremely valuable for him. You know, he had kind of a solitary life in some ways, but he was always connected with people in other ways. So he never was completely apart. And that's kind of an advantage of online community. And it occurred to me that, you know, we should make the distinction here that what we're talking about is, it may have been a precursor to social media, but it's not the same thing exactly, because in social media you have what I refer to as drive-by posts that are sort of ephemeral, but in community you have these long conversations that can last for years, you know, and you build history with people, and you have this sense of being in a place with the same set of people. On a social network like Facebook or whatever, you may build your network of friends and have conversations with them, but it's not like you're going somewhere where you're sitting down, you know, that sense of going to a place and being there with people and sitting around and having conversations with them that are sustained.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Facebook and its ilk, I think, is a lot about the like, right? Does someone like your post? And I know this is going to be a radical revelation here, but on Facebook, I've liked posts that I haven't read, right? And that, you know, because I get to look like I'm this generous, loving, liking person. And you can't get away with that on the well, you know, or on other, as you say, online communities, because people really want to hear what you have to say in a substantive way about something. What's being talked about is in a deeper way than just that I liked it. Not to say that there isn't a lot of just delightful kinds of socializing on the well, which is, you know, of the idea of, oh, you know, my son and his partner just adopted a kid, you know, and here's how I'm feeling as a grandparent or whatever. There is all that, but the response is not just like. The response is, I think, deeper than that. So, yeah. That's the John Coate model, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a model that may have felt for a time that it was kind of lost in the shuffle for social media, but I see people coming back to the well. I'm kind of an example of that because for several years, I was much less active on the well. I was always a host there, but I really wasn't doing as much. And now I'm like constantly in conversation there. In fact, it's probably, I may be overdoing it. I may be over communicating.
I doubt it.
Are you very active in an online community now? The well or elsewhere? I mean, you're a part owner of the well, aren't you?
I am. I'm a very small owner of the well, and I'm there, but I'm not. I mean, I've never been one of the super posters on the well, and I do post in private conferences. But I mean, I just love it. I mean, in a way, I'm a lurker at times, in that I'm somebody who I love on the well discovering that someone who maybe I know in one conference, in one context, turns out to be the world's greatest expert on a topic that I'm only now discovering is fascinating or useful to me. So I would say I'm more and more, I'm in a way I'm like you, is I'm more and more getting back to the well and spending more time there, because there's nothing like the community. I mean, recently just reconnecting because of both happiness and then loss. And that's really been meaningful to me to reconnect with people. And just remembering what Ed meant to me. Another friend of mine on the well who died recently, and remembering like, wow, I knew that guy forever, yeah. It seems like, and what a generous soul, you know? And at the same time, making new friends on the well. Like, that's been fascinating coming back, is realizing I sort of, you know, I'm an introvert. And so, you know, I can only connect so much with people without having to disconnect. I'm not fed by connecting with people, and I need to disconnect from that. I'm married to a guy who's an extrovert, so I know he's the kind of guy, he's nurtured by connecting with people, you know, and it's beautiful to watch, but it's not me.
Well, so you have this involvement with community memory and some of the other things we talked about, and like CPSR, I mean, I had connections with CPSR. I had a friend, Gary Chapman, who was really involved with CPSR at one time.
He's another.
The late Gary Chapman.
Yeah, one of a kind. He just remarkable guy. I worked with Gary and love him to pieces. He was so committed to technology, taking care of people who work in technology, that technology could be warm and personal, that military uses of technology were unnecessary and hideous, and that the people who made technology could have power by standing up to those forces. I mean, he was a force of nature,
and CBSR
was as well, I think.
He really got the military thing. He had been a Green Beret at one time.
Yep. Yeah.
But I bring up CPSR and community memory and so forth as a setup for talking about how at some point you became a playwright and got involved in performance. And we'd really like to hear about that. How did you, was that a transition or were you always doing that?
Well, I had done a lot of theater as a kid, and I had studied performance in college. And then I did get hooked into, because I'd like read about community memory and read about CPSR, and I'd sort of said, wow, those, if I could work for any organizations in the world, those were the two. And I ended up working for them both. And, you know, I'm not a great performer, though I like to perform. And at that, when I was growing up in the library, if you went and looked up plays, there were only two women playwrights. One was Lillian Hellman, and the other was Claire Booth Luce, both white, and both on different ends of the political spectrum. But I think it never occurred to me to be a playwright. It just seemed too hard. And then as I actually threw the well, Brady Lee and Martha Sukup, Brady being a fabulous performer, one of the world's greatest clowns, Martha Sukup being a science fiction writer. And the two of them were writing plays. And they were again, that's something that an online community does for you. They really encouraged me. You know, they saw my early plays, which I think they probably, and particularly Brady, because she's someone who doesn't criticize, she just shuts up. But they were both very supportive of me and doing that. And I loved it. And in San Francisco, I was a member of Playground, which is a fabulous playwright and play incubator organization that now has branches in not just San Francisco and Oakland, but also LA and New York. And they're really into encouraging all kinds of people to write plays so that it's not just Lillian Hellman and Claire Booth Luce. Claire Booth Luce, of course, being married to Luce of Time magazine. So she had a lot of, and she was a senator. She had a lot of resources to put to playwriting. And through Playground, you not only meet other playwrights, but you meet fabulous actors, the best directors. I mean, they've built not an online community, but a theatrical community, which nurtures playwrights. So that's what's really kept me going as a playwright, though it's interesting that you say that two of the plays that I'm proudest of are related to technology. Actually, three of them. One of them is the one that recently had a stage reading through Playground, Seven Secrets of Teaching Online, which is about March 2020 through September 2020, and these college teachers trying to figure out how to use technology to connect with students, and in the process, having all kinds of personal connections evolve. And then the other one is First, which is the story of Bill Gates at 19, fighting with the ham operators and, hobbyists who wanted to share his software and felt that they had the idea that you couldn't share software was just not something that someone who hacked around with hardware to do cool things would ever dream could be true. And so that's a play that looks at that fight, which, you know, propelled Gates into being Bill Gates, as we now know him. And also, I think, made transform other people into thinking about we really need to preserve the liberating impacts of technology.
Well, do you have, speak of technology, do you have plans of actually performing Seven Secrets of Teaching online?
Actually, the first reading of it was done online, because part of what I develop is online tool for teachers called Soon, which you would have no idea what I'm imitating by calling it Soon, of course. And so the first reading was online, and it's written so it can be performed in the theater and also performed over Zoom or any of these other video conferencing systems. And I have to say that the actors just leapt into using Zoom to create the play.
Well, I saw the reading and thought it was a wonderful play, but I was also kind of curious about. I mean, it kind of seemed like they were using Zoom, but it also seemed like there was kind of more going on there, and I was wondering, first of all, was that being done live, totally live? And if so, how did some of that stuff work? Like the sense that a guy was driving the car.
Yeah. If you saw it on May 21st, it was live. And I believe that you can still see a copy of that if you contact Jim Kleinman at playgroundsf.com.
I checked and it's still out there.
But they did have a fabulous guy, Colin, and I'm so sorry, Colin, I can't remember your last name, who came up with some of the visuals, including brilliantly. There's a guy who begins the play by dumping his apartment so that he can buy a Tesla. And throughout the play till the end, you see him driving. And they had a wonderful background, so you had a sense that this teacher is in this class on learning on Soon, learning how to teach online while he's driving around the Bay Area. So, yeah. So we did have that kind of support. But that said, those visuals, really fantastic. And other than that, it was really actors, stage manager, director who pulled it together in terms of
that was Colin Johnson doing the visual design.
Thank you. Thank you, John, so much for saying that. Yeah.
I checked the playbill.
Yeah. Well, you're way ahead of me in terms of finding, you know, credible sources. But yeah, he did a fantastic job, as did the whole team. It was really great. Really great.
So what was it like kind of putting that together? Did you work pretty closely with Tracy Ward in that production?
Yeah, she's a super director of both film and theater. And I think because of her involvement with film as well as theater, I think she would admit she's not a technologist, but she was able to have a vision for how it would look and how it would come together. And the other thing that I really loved about working with her is she also, I think like me, understands that theater really lives in the actors. And she's just a dynamite at working with actors. And some actors are less comfortable working in a Zoom environment or a YouTube Live or whatever. And she was very good at nurturing these performances. And the actors were also dynamite. What amazes me about it was I wrote the play, you know, very quickly. And then similarly, Tracy and her team got the play up so quickly. And even though it was a staged reading, it looked lively. You know, the actors were really in the moment with it.
Was this something where you, you know, you sort of found yourself in the pandemic? You saw that people were Zooming, and I guess you teach too, so I assume that you were doing some of the same kind of like Zoom classes and things. So
yeah,
what was the impetus for you to write the play? I mean, kind of how did that come together in your head?
In some ways, John, it was a revenge comedy, in that I taught at three different schools, and they're all fabulous. San Francisco State, the greatest university in the country. Berkeley City College, a terrific community college, and then City College of San Francisco, which is just fabulous, fabulous school. But I teach three places. We go online in March, and all the schools say you have to, even though you just brought your course online. And I also had experience teaching hybrid courses, half online, half face-to-face, but you have to take certain kinds of training to do it. And of course, each school had a different training to take. So I'm taking three different classes in how to teach online, which is the kind of thing that forces people to write plays. And in fact, in one of them, I even said, you know, I said, oh, you know, I'm really enjoying this because I'm going to write a play about it. And everyone sort of, you know, ignored me. But that was really the impetus that I saw. I just felt like there's something really interesting about people who are teachers suddenly becoming students, that whole thing. I think there's something about academia where there's a lot of imposter syndrome. And so it was good to throw an imposter into the room. And also I felt that I was really interested in writing something from the pandemic about people getting closer together, because just there was so much written, not necessarily plays, but written about distance and feeling separate from people. And I wanted to write a little bit about the ways that people connected. Because that was very interesting to me, and is interesting to me. Why do people connect?
The fact that so many people had to suddenly live online rather than living in the so-called real world. I was amazed at the way people adapted. I know a lot of musicians that suddenly had to find a way of still, you know, being, you know, important to their fan base, or just to be doing something that they love, and you couldn't do it live in person. So going online, I saw so many incredible adaptations. I saw some really horrible ones too, but that's just the nature of the beast. But it was great to see that so many artists and performers were able to step up and adapt.
I totally agree with you. And I think musicians were particularly outrageous in their ability to collaborate online, because it's something that seems to me, as a non-musician, pretty impossible. Like, how does a string quartet, or how does a jazz quintet, or even a symphony orchestra, when everybody's somewhere else, how do they manage to make music together, and then actually hearing and often being able to see these collaborations over distance was just powerfully remarkable, you know, and it says something, I think, we, you know, about artists' ability to step up like that. I will do a shout out to one of my favorite musicians and also my co-host in the Well in the Beatles conference, David Gans, who, you know, is doing these concerts at 4 o'clock to a committed fan base who want to hear him, you know, like they're just there for him. And he had the guts. I mean, I don't think I would have the guts to put out, okay, I'm going to be here every day at this time, show up, and I'm going to play. And he has, like, these people who he makes their day sometimes. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I just wonder how long this can continue now that people are transitioning again out of the online world and back into the real world. But there are a lot of things that were developed that I think may actually have some staying power of, you know, the online entertainment, because there are many people who don't have access to big theaters or big music venues or live theater. And it's an important thing that, you know, the rest of the world is able to, you know, access this stuff. And so I'm hoping that they find a hybrid somehow.
Yeah. And I think they will. I mean, I think that performing artists have been spoiled. My friend Jonathan Luskin, who's a terrific playwright, had through Playground an online production of his play Perfect, which is about gene splicing and about CRISPR. And it was remarkable because he said to me afterwards, part of what was so thrilling about these performances is people from around the world could show up. And so he could get this play out to all kinds of people who really cared about that issue or care about him as a playwright. And they were all watching it together because he was doing it, you know, it was happening live, but at different times all over the world. And he was just deeply inspired by who would show up in the audience. Now, if he'd done it in San Francisco, it still would have been terrific play, terrific performances, but the person from New Zealand, you know, couldn't have been there. You know, people from New England might, you know, couldn't have seen it. You know, friends from Japan couldn't have shown up. So it's how theater people keep that going and how we figure that out, I think, is going to be really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, you could anytime theoretically create a one-off sort of recorded version of a play that could be streamed over YouTube, something like, I don't know, that Andrew Lloyd Webber's stuff was being streamed. He had them giving his plays away basically via YouTube during the pandemic, just to like give people something to do. And I wasn't like a huge fan of his stuff, but we watched The Phantom of the Opera and it was actually quite good and we kind of enjoyed it and it worked. It really worked, but it was like a recorded version of the play. They just recorded the play and were streaming it. But it's a lot more interesting to think about creating a play with online performance in mind. And maybe the idea of doing a play live over and over again online, which I don't think anybody's done yet. You know, I mean, there've been things like your play where it was a one-off streaming and it's recorded now. So it can be streamed over and over again. Theoretically, but to do it again live every night would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And that did happen. You know, I mean, I think there are theater companies that have played with that. There is an issue, and it's a very real one, protecting workers, because, you know, actors deserve to get paid for their work. And if you take a live play and you record it, they should still be paid as we're continuing to use their remarkable performances that make them happen. And I'm not sure what the deal is with the different actors unions, but I think it's something that producers can work out. And I think actors like to be seen. I can talk about the downside of it, however, as long as nobody tells, because one of the things that I really struggled with as an audience member is not treating it like it's TV, right? I mean, you know, I won't say what plays, but I'd be watching a performance of a play and the phone would ring and the performance is live, but I'd think, oh, you know, my phone would never go off in the theater, but you know, I'm home, so there it is, and who could it be, or whatever, or, you know, someone comes to the door, or even I notice, oh, there's a crossword puzzle over there, and I just that was the Shakespeare quote. I'll put it in here. So one of the things that I'm really interested in, and I don't know if there's been research done, is when we're watching theater at home, do we treat it like TV in that we walk in and out? And if so, that's a different modality than in the theater, because although there are theater people who walk out of theaters, most people don't, just out of respect for the actors, right?
Well, I just had a relevant experience, which it wasn't watching a play, but it was watching a movie from a play, In the Heights.
Yes.
So that was streamed on HBO Max. And we watched it and we loved it. We thought it was great on HBO Max. And we liked it so much that a couple of days later, we went to an IMAX theater and saw it on the big screen. And I was shocked at how much I missed when I was watching it at home on, I mean, we have a big television set, but I realized the degree of my distractibility when I was watching it on the television set in my living room versus watching it in the theater. And I think that is going to be a problem, and people will just miss things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a fabulous play too. So I'm thrilled.
It's fantastic.
I'm thrilled they made that into a movie and got John Chu of all people to direct it. I had a similar thing in reverse. A great San Francisco playwright, Michael Gene Sullivan, who's part of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, wrote a fantastic version of 1984, which they created a production of. And I'm trying to remember, I don't think it was live. I think it was streaming of a video of it. And I had the experience, it was probably the best first act I saw on Zoom. But it was so intense for my husband and me. We said, we can't watch this in our living room. George Orwell would marry Michael Gene Sullivan if he could, because it was exactly the impact that that's supposed to have. And yet it, for us, it was like, I don't want to think of my living room as being that. Which was so fabulous, and yet I couldn't watch the whole thing. So that's also the other side of that. And of course, on our TVs, we get all kinds of violence, and it just washes over us. But he got at something psychological about fascism and totalitarianism that was just profoundly upsetting, really.
Yeah, it's a scary story, and it's unfortunately too relevant right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
I found that the temptation to do other things than to pay attention is the big problem with viewing in the comfort of your own homes. When you're in a theater, You're going to be wearing clothes. At home, it's clothing optional. I've been clothing optional on some of our Zoom things, but I won't say when. But it was...
I just presumed you were now.
It was audio only. But in person, there were certain standards that people have been raised, hopefully, to accommodate. When you go to a theater, you don't go and bring in your sandwiches and a six pack of beer and start imbibing in the middle of a play. Although,
speak for yourself.
Well, my mother would have, she was a big fan of theater, so she would have killed me just for thinking that.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because part of it is what TV has taught us. How TV has taught us to behave. I remember I was pretty little, 8 or 9, after when JFK was shot. And I was home, I think I was home from school, or maybe it was a Saturday, but I was ironing and watching TV. And, suddenly a shot rings out and Jack Ruby, who was just being brought through, is shot on TV.
Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby.
pardon me. Thank goodness you're here, John, or a generation of young people would never be able to figure that out. But what's so fascinating is I told that student, and I hope I told that to students, and I hope I told it correctly, that Oswald, you know, I watched Oswald get killed. And they said, well, what were you watching? You know, and I was saying, well, you know, I was just watching news of him being coming out here. And they said, well, was it just the focus on him? Was it a news program, whatever? And I realized I had been ironing. So I'd sort of been watching and sort of not, you know? And
out of the corner of your eye, sort of, huh?
Yeah. And I think that that's sort of the way I at least still watch television. I do get engrossed. You know, if you're going to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald, I wake up. But I can also, you know, as Scoop sort of eloquently said, I can do other things and still feel semi-connected to it. And our experience in theater, what playwrights are hoping for in theater, is that you're really connected with those actors in that moment, you know? And it's just, that's different than TV.
And we really have become even more distractible because of the sort of ADD driving character of our internet experience. You know, it tends to create an attention deficit even worse than we might otherwise have had. And I'm very aware of that. I mean, my level of attention now is nowhere like it was when I was younger. And it might be that I'm just getting old, but I think it's also because I've been sort of multitasking online for years and years. And you know, as you get older, it's harder to multitask. But what that really means is the balls you were able to keep in the air are dropping all over the place. But anyway, I wanted to get to one other thing. I'm interested in the process of writing a play, particularly the question of, once you're into writing the play, do the characters tend to sort of take over once you've sort of created the characters in your head?
Well, you know, it's such a great question, because in this play, they definitely did. And it's very interesting to me, because particularly Leon, who's somebody who is sort of the stereotype of the pompous professor, he became, so his life was so much richer than I imagined as he began to, as I was writing, and I was writing lines for them. I'm not the kind of writer who like has a character come and talk, whisper in my ear, I want to say this now. I'm not that. But just as I'd write the character and he'd sort of expand on me and other aspects of his life, his partner, Jeff, who he has this great relationship with, and we never see Jeff, but we hear about him. We learn that he has these two daughters and they're trying to figure out how to keep him from fighting. We also learn that his obsession is suffixes. And he, throughout the play, you know, he's trying to abandon it, but is still tempted by suffixes. So for me, at least, I think that characters do grow in a way. But I also think that there's a way in which, and, you know, Aristotle said, you know, plays are really drama, particularly tragedy, and is characters in action. So what's interesting about characters is seeing what they do. And in this play, in Seven Secrets of Teaching Online, they're basically in a Zoom-like class for a lot of the play, but they're also, as we've been talking about, even though they're in the class, they're in their homes, doing their own thing at the same time. And so we're discovering them doing things that are sort of beyond my dreams of what they would do when I first started. I had one, the one thing that I knew was that someone was going to discover their family. That was sort of the one plot point, because I wanted, as I say, I was interested in writing a comedy. And if I'm going to write a comedy, as I have to find connection. I'm not enough of a satirist to just satirize without that heart energy going through it.
So that twist or that revelation that came later in the play was always there in your mind?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, when you sit down to start the writing process, to begin writing a play, what do you create first? Do you create the world of the play, or do you create the characters, or something else?
For me, it's characters. I mean, it's so different for every playwright. I love to hear playwrights talk about it, because they'll say, oh, I do this. And I'm like, really? I could never write a play like that. And I do think it's also slightly different for each play. But for example, when I was going to write the play about Bill Gates, which in some ways is about privilege, right? Because that's Bill Gates, you know? It's amazing how much you can get done in your life if you have that kind of a background. But so I was thinking, who's the foil for him? And there was a character I sort of knew would be there, who then became the foil. Clearly someone as smart as Bill Gates, but came from a different background, runaway from home, and who had really made her life all by herself, right? And that it was fascinating to me, like, what? The waitress is the person who's gonna be the parallel to Bill Gates? Like, I think maybe a smart playwright would have planned that. But for me, as I was thinking about how are we introducing him, she suddenly became more than I thought she was. And became really, in a way, it's her play. And Bill Gates is just there so she can get your attention. You know, that's probably how Melinda felt too.
I suppose it's kind of difficult to be creating a fiction around a real person, you know.
Yeah.
To what extent do you have to honor the reality of Bill Gates when you make the play?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think that's like a fabulous, fabulous question and totally worth meditating on. But Bill Gates has really created Bill Gates, right? We have no idea who he is, you know? And in fact, I worked with, I can't remember the guy. Oh my God. One of the people who I talked to while I wrote the play was someone who had worked with Bill Gates. At MITS, the place where the Altair computer was set up. And this guy, you know, the way he'd describe him was so nothing-like. And yet, I mean, Bill Gates is someone like in our corporate marketing world has been created, right?
This is created. Bill Gates, isn't it?
That's him. Oh my God, that's him. But, you know, what I wanted to do was show him before the marketing had gotten to him and show him, you know, 19, 20 years old, college dropout, trying to get his mother off his back and figure out and fight for what he thought was the right thing to do, which was not have people use his software.
Have you seen that mugshot of Bill Gates?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he put that out as a, you know, because he didn't want someone else to put it out, right? And he could put it out like, look at me, I'm the rebel.
Well, yeah, and he's trying to convince people that he's a human being.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which has been a little questionable from time to time. Well, do you bring in any of the open source sort of opponents of Bill Gates, any of the actual characters?
No. It was funny because Lee Felsenstein was one of the people when we did the play in San Francisco.
I'm thinking about Lee.
Yeah, I mean, oh my God, another remarkable human being. But, you know, and he was someone who, in a way, one of the characters is based on, but I didn't make it him. I wanted one person to embody that ethic. And that
you
guy
got a play based on Richard Stallman.
Yeah.
That would be a very interesting play.
Yeah, it would. I don't think it's my play to write. Maybe you should write that play. But yeah, it'd be a great one. The other person is who I couldn't write a play about, but I think I wanted someone like him in my play, but couldn't really do it, was Ted Nelson. You know, because he's
absolutely
a,
yeah.
Yeah, another
Xanadu. You
know, yeah, hardcore.
Well, in writing about Bill Gates, I'm surprised you didn't use Clippy as a character.
Clippy?
The word pop-up that Melinda created.
Right.
That would be a nice character.
A play about a paperclip.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah.
That was probably one of the most irritating things ever foisted upon the public by Microsoft.
Yep, and there's been a lot of irritating things foisted too, so that's saying a lot.
I guess you could find all of these little sort of mascot kind of characters that have become icons for various technologies and make them characters in a play.
That too. That would be fun. That would be fun. Someone should write that.
So what are you working on right now? Is it the Bill Gates play or is that complete?
Well, I'm doing a rewrite of the Bill Gates play. Because I felt like I felt it was not tough enough in a way. And I'm writing with Katia Rivera a wonderful play about women in invisibility called The Invisible Project. And it's about two women scientists who discover the secret of invisibility. And we developed it because we had a bunch of teas with women talking about their feelings of being invisible, whether it was something that made them feel vulnerable or something that made them feel powerful. And so that play is almost done, but it's a blast to do. It's a wonderful collaboration.
You know, do you have a sense where it will be performed? Has that worked out?
Yeah, no, I wish I could say that right here, right now, but I can't. But anybody who's interested in women and invisibility in play form should talk to me. It's a good one. It's really intense and marvelous.
And hopefully you'll come back when that play is complete and performed.
I would love to do that. That would be a blast.
Yeah, we'd love to talk some more.
Yeah.
So the things that I wanted to know about was other plays that you've written that we haven't talked about yet. I know you've written several.
I wrote one about Queen Isabella and the Indians who Columbus kidnapped and brought back to Spain, which was called The Secrets of the World, which looks at sort of her both cruelty and impossibility. Like, she can't stand the idea that there are these people as smart as she is who know more than she does, who have been brought back to her as if they're gifts.
And they're supposed to be savages.
Then, of course. And then I wrote a country and Western musical based on the myth of Gaia and her son who castrates his father, which seems like a theme for a country and Western musical, of course. And then I also wrote a retelling of the Hephaestus myth. He's the guy who's the god of the Greek god of fire and the forge. And he was the guy who had to do the dirty work of chaining Prometheus to the hill. And so what I wrote was the play of how he felt when he got home after doing that. And of course, he's also famous in myth as the first person to to create robots. And Hephaestus is known for having these three female robots. So it's about them and the sort of them rebelling. So it's about a robot rebelling.
He was a developer.
He was a developer. Yeah. That's a good way to put what
strange.
He was. Yeah.
There was a play about robots many years ago. I don't know very much about it. RUR is just what I was going to say, by Carl Capek.
Yeah, fabulous play.
Have you seen that play?
I have never seen it, but I've read it. He invented the word robot, I believe, in that play. Is that possible?
That's very possible.
Yeah, he also wrote a fabulous novel called The Absolute at Large about a guy who develops a place where he invents God. I mean, where God comes through and it just drives everyone nuts. It's really a wonderful
book. Wait, it's more like a portal for God?
Yeah, in a way it is.
God?
Yeah, that's, you know the lingo, John. It's a portal for God, which is, you know, it's the kind of thing that everyone looks forward to until it happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Like so
I'm not
many.
Really sure I want to talk to God.
Right.
I thought the portal for God was Fox News, but maybe not.
Bravo.
Somebody should write a play about QAnon.
Well, there's a little bit of QAnon in the Seven Secrets of Teaching Online. There's a young kid in it who falls in love with a young woman who's into QAnon. So, yeah.
Well, the big news on QAnon today on the news was that they're afraid that the disenchanted QAnon followers who didn't see all their predictions come to pass are going to turn violent and, you know, take up arms, and the other half are just going to disappear. So it's kind of a split down the middle of QAnon.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because it really feels like, and maybe people have written about this, but that Trump is really playing it like a cult, where now he's saying, okay, I didn't come back January 6th, but now I'm going to come back. I'm going to be resurrected in December or something.
August, I think.
Or August? So
yeah,
I guess
he's in a hurry.
Be that soon. But yeah, which is sort of typical when you've had a cult, you know, like saying we're going to be taken up to space. I forget that cult. And then they don't come.
Yeah.
You keep coming up with new dates.
The Heaven's also. Gate, folks. Scientology is a good example of what Trump wants to be.
Right.
Getting all the famous
folks
to
really
follow.
Pretty competent. It's not exact. Scientology's, it's almost too well organized to be a cult exactly.
Except it's similar because right now there are so few Scientologists, but they own so much real estate, just like, which is very like Trump. Right? He doesn't have that many followers, but he owns a lot of real estate. Or he did. I guess he's gone bankrupt on so many of them. Doesn't. But Scientology is interesting, again, in how difficult it is for people to, you know, it's the old sunk cost fallacy, that if you keep paying thousands of dollars for workshops, it becomes very hard to say, oh, maybe we aren't aliens. Now that when you're told the secret, it's like, okay, that sounds like whatever to me, but I've spent $40,000 on workshops, so I'm going to hang out here.
It makes me think about Est. The way Est always struck me was, my idea was that Werner Erhard was a salesman who realized that he didn't have to have a product, that he could just do the sales activity. The sales process itself would just work. You know, and basically what he would be selling is his brand of enlightenment, I guess. I mean, selling a sense of being connected to something, you know.
Yeah.
It was a very strange organization.
Yeah. You should write about that.
It was a forerunner of the vaporware creators from Silicon Valley. It's like they never really came up with that magical program, but they sure sold a lot of them.
That's really like
good. It's hard to find really good snake oil.
And yet people keep buying it. You know? People keep buying it.
You remember Clifford Stoll wrote a book called Silicon Snake Oil,
yes,
about the internet years ago. And it's like, maybe we should listen to him.
Yeah.
No, he was onto something.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good in that book. There's some things I didn't buy into, but yeah. Cliff is a thoughtful guy. Thoughtful, yeah.
So, Evie, I think we're close to the end of our hour here. And thank you so much for coming. Do you have any last words for us? Anything else you wanted to discuss?
It's been a blast. I mean, I really love the fact that this was a place I knew I could come and talk both about playwriting, which obviously I'm totally in love with, but also talk about technology and talk about it over time. And as you said so eloquently, talk about online communities versus social media. And I just think, I mean, I love you guys because I think you create a place for discussions like this.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.